do my head toss, check my nails. Baby, how you feeling? Head toss, check my nails. Baby, how you feeling?
Woo, child. Hey, you guys, this is Sarah Troutman, and welcome to Reveal, the podcast where we talk about incredible stories of amazing women and how they've used the best of behavioral science to find a pathway forward. I am very excited today for my guest. And there's a number of reasons that I'm excited about this guest. One, she's a new friend and I haven't seen her since the summer when we got to sit down together with a couple of colleagues in LA. Two, as she knows, because I sang this to her when we talked on the phone yesterday, she is my favorite Latina. So without further ado, I present to you Carolina Gonzalez. Tápame con tu rebozo, llorar porque me muero de frío. Carolina.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
Oh, man. I was looking forward. I mean, people don't know this, but I'm going to tell them now so they know this. Like, we talked yesterday for like an hour, and we actually even talked, was it a couple months ago? Because you just got your BCBA, and you were like, oh my gosh, Sarah, you know, you're like, there really is, like, it's such a difference when you're transitioning from not being, you know, certified to like having the, like, you know, certified clinical role and some of the skills that you have to learn. And I remember when I first met you in June in LA this past summer, you were, you know, so confident. You're like, okay, I'm not a BCBA yet. I'm taking my test. I guarantee you I'm going to pass. And then I'm going to probably call you up just because, you know, I'll be a new professional and I want to talk to you about some things. And I was like, girl, here's my number. And then you did call me up and then we did talk, and I've just been so, you know, ecstatic for you, to watch you, you know, on this professional journey. And I'm really excited for you to share more of a personal journey today, because I learned a little bit about your backstory and, you know, kind of family history when we were in LA together, but this is really an opportunity for us to talk about it in more depth. And it's such a tremendous story. And it just, you know, makes me even more proud of who you are and what you're doing. And I want everyone else to know about it too. So let's talk about it. So we're going to start at the beginning. And that is you being born in LA, but very specifically in LA, you were born in Watts. And this is a really, you know, integral part of your story, because a lot of people have kind of very specific ways that they view Watts. Do you want to kind of tell us why?
Well, it's predominantly an area that has like lower income, and it's known for that. It's probably also Black and brown. Mm-hmm. It's probably known for all its negative features, like gang banging, mm-hmm. The riots, yep. Back in like the early 2000s. So it has like a huge stigma to that environment. Yeah.
And when you were born in Watts, you know, another piece of your story that's really important for people to understand is that you are first generation. So can you give us a really brief history of where were your mom and dad coming from?
Yeah, so my dad is from Guatemala. Mm-hmm. He's also born there. And my mom's from Mexico. Mm-hmm. She was also born there. As far as like the culture, I mean, it was a huge, like, drastic change coming from like an environment where it's very conservative. It's not city based. Mm-hmm. So coming to a space where it's city and it's a whole new language, culture, values, morals. Yeah, it's a huge difference. Mm-hmm.
And you are one of five siblings?
No, I am one out of six.
Six. Okay. Six, and I was like, yeah. Am I off by one? I'm like, it's five or yeah. six. Okay. Yeah. So is it three girls, three boys, or four girls, two boys?
It's three boys, three girls.
Three boys, three girls. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're, you know, first generation, you're born in Watts, you're in this very large Latin family. Can you kind of talk to me about What happened when you were around the age of five? What did you start noticing when you were five?
Well, when I was five, that's when my mother was diagnosed with schizophrenia. I want to say a little bit before that, my earliest memories, I remember my uncles and my aunts coming to the house and what seemed to be like questioning my mom. Mm-hmm. She would engage in like irrational behaviors. Like she would say that someone was talking on top, like in the roof or saying things. And I remember her telling me like, you hear it too, right? You hear it. And I'm like four and a half. And I'm looking at her and looking at my uncles. And yeah, I agreed with her. I was like, yeah, yeah. And they looked at me. And I remember them looking at me like, you know, it's not true. Mm-hmm. And it happened in the night. I remember this. It was like clear as day. I don't have a lot of memories in my childhood. That's what I can say. But I do remember that night. I remember I was with my siblings. We're right in front of the TV watching Simpsons. And we were all hovered with each other. And we hear a knock, which typically, you know, we don't have anyone come at night. So I remember looking and seeing people. But I didn't have much mind to it. And next thing I know, we were walking down and I saw my brother like going into a police car and my other brother going into a different police car. And I looked and turned around as I was going into another police car. And my mom was just like standing like frozen, like she had like the plainest look. I couldn't really describe it. I went in with my sister and they told us they were going to take us to McDonald's.
Yeah.
And I just remember my heart like shaking. Like it was just like, I can't really describe it. I didn't know what was going on. I just knew something wasn't right. And I looked at my sister and she was like super happy. She was like, McDonald's, and jumping up and down. And, you know, it brought me like a little smirk to see her smile. Mm-hmm. And I just remember we were driving what seemed to be like the longest drive of my whole like life. Yeah. And we passed like multiple McDonald's and I'm like, hey, like there's a McDonald's there. And I turn around, there's another McDonald's. And then I turn around, looked at my sister and she was asleep. Mm-hmm. And we arrived to a lady's home and she said she was going to care for us. I was really confused. I didn't know what was going on. She said, you know, she was really nice. She said we were going to be sleeping there for the night. Mm-hmm. She showed us her room and she showed us her daughter's room. She said her husband and her two daughters had passed away in a car accident. And we were going to be sleeping there. And I got really scared. I was like,
sure.
Whoa.
You're like, why am I going to be sleeping like, in a room that someone that died? That was their room.
Yeah. And I remember the next morning, she wanted us to eat. My sister was eating with her, talking to her. And I didn't want to eat. I just felt really like bad and sad. I didn't want to like talk to her. I didn't want to eat. My sister seemed to be doing very well. You know, but I was just like confused. And second of all, they didn't take us to McDonald's.
I know, you're like, what the heck? You're like, the one McDonald's thing that we thought that this was going to be cool, and there was no McDonald's anywhere. So your mother was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And just like as an example, something that we had talked about, like this manifested sometimes in her engaging in really erratic behavior. So she thought that she was, you know, hearing people that weren't there. At one point, I know that you said that she was like chasing your sister around with a knife. And so what happened to you and your siblings is you were removed from the home and put into foster care as a result of that. But there was one person in your family that was like, I'm sorry, the kids are not going to be separated and I'm going to take care of them. And that person was your grandmother.
Yes.
And so she stepped in and took all six of you guys.
Yes, she was 57.
She was 57 at the time. She took all six of you guys into her home. Plus, she still had one of her children at home. So she had seven children. She was making $11,000 a year. Because what was her job, Carolina?
She wasn't working.
She wasn't working. So she just had some support from social services?
Yeah, prior to that, prior to getting all the six kids, she was working in ironing, like a factory, ironing clothes and like sewing clothes. So she was a factory worker. That's what she was doing prior to that. She would clean, which she tells us now, she would clean like hotels. She would drive like far distances to clean like, you know, wealthy people's homes, things like that. Yeah.
And this is your maternal grandmother. So this is your mother's mom. And just really briefly, because I think this is a really key piece to your story, is to understand a little bit of your grandmother's story. So can you just tell us really briefly, like, where was she born and then how did she come to the U.S.? Because I think that plays a really big part in how she interacted with you and just kind of, you know, helps us understand her better.
Yeah, she was born in Mexico, a state called Nayarit. It was a small town, there's almost like no people around. So you have to walk like a whole hour to see like another person's home. She mentioned like, you know, she got married like at 16. Her and her husband like moved in together. Her husband built his house, you know, with his own hands. Together they had six kids. Unfortunately, he passed away. And at that time, it was very like male dominant, what we call machismo, right? So the man is the one who brings the money into the home. The man is the head of the household. The man is the king. You have to obey and listen to the man while the woman just cares, nurtures, cleans for the kids.
Yes.
So she talks about that, and she mentions things like she didn't know what she would do. You know, there's no income, there's no money. She has to feed six kids. She was like getting it was kind of like a farm where she had chickens, ducks, pigs, cattle, and she couldn't care for those cattle. So she started selling them to have food for her kids. She started getting the eggs and walking far distances just to sell eggs. And it became a point where she wasn't like sustaining. So she had to make a really tough decision, and she came illegally to America. And she left her six kids behind with her mother. She says that was like the toughest thing that she's ever experienced besides losing her husband. Like the toughest thing. She was out here in America for 5 years, and she will live like in like an uncle's house or an aunt's house. She says she was just balancing, like living in the couch, paying whatever she could and saving all that money. And in the interim, she was also in the process of becoming legal, paying all those fees and trying to learn English. And she saved money to bring all of her kids to America legally within 5 years.
Yeah.
So that was my grandma.
Right. And so those kids, your mother was one of those children that was brought to the U.S. And so your grandmother basically, you know, had to, you know, make this like really excruciating choice of, do I stay in Mexico where likely I am not going to be able to provide for my family and I have no husband in a culture that, like you said, is male dominated, or do I go to the U.S. where illegally, because I know that I will probably be able to have more choices and be able to provide for my kids because I'll have more options in terms of work. And I think, you know, what's so fascinating to me about your grandmother is it's like she saved, you know, six kids, not just once in her life, but twice.
Twice.
And something that you and I have talked about so much is growing up with, you know, because so people know, like, you stayed with your grandmother raised you and your sibling. Yes. Because your mother, because of her mental illness, she was not able to do that. And she still isn't. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I know that you and your grandmother sometimes would have like conflict because she was like old school. You know, she grew up in this like very rural community. And so she wanted you to serve your brothers and she wanted you to clean the house, but your brothers weren't doing any of that shit. And you were like, abuela.
Like, what's going on?
Yeah. And when we were talking yesterday, it was so interesting to me. And we were talking about, you know, like what did like, you learn so much about like culture and stuff, like watching like TV. So you're like, here I am like watching TV and like, you know, all looking at all of these different like kind of American type of values and like, you can do anything or you can make your own choices. But I'm living in this like very traditional Mexican household. And, you know, my grandmother on the one hand has like, you know, exhibited incredible strength of character and perseverance in her own life, you know, time after time. Yet she's like kind of shoving those traditional values down your throat and down your sister's throats. And, you know, it's this like interesting conflict and confluence of like older generation. And like, you're the first generation of like an American kid. Like, yes, you're Latin, but you're born in the US. And how do you kind of reconcile those things, you know, saying, because your grandma's like, she took advantage of, you know, coming to America. She knew that there were more opportunities. She wanted more for her family. So she did that. And now you're almost taking it to the next level. And, but that caused conflict because that was also then going against, you know, part of her values as, you know, a Catholic, as a, you know, Mexican woman. So how were you guys, like, did you guys get in fights about this? And how did you, like, when you were a teenager, like, what happened? How did you deal with that together?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I was definitely not her favorite around the time I started realizing gender differences and racial, differences. I mean, I remember her, you know, helping her cook as early as, like, 8 years old.
Yeah.
Making rice, making beans, helping her make enchiladas. And I remember being so happy. Like, oh, yes, I want to learn. You know, mm-hmm. I wanted to learn. Like, I wanted to, you know, see everyone happy and, like, just help her. And I think it was around middle school is when I started realizing, like, hey, like, my brother's not doing it. Mm-hmm. My older brother's not doing it. I was like, why? And she said, like, men don't belong in the kitchen. Women do. I'm like, but why? She was like, this is just it.
Yeah.
There's no, like, how it's there's done. No other. Yeah. Yeah, this is just it. This is what women do. Women cook and clean. But, like, he also has an arm. He also has legs. Like, he can't learn this? Like, I'm so confused. And I think I was coming from a space where I'm just really asking. You know, mm-hmm. I'm just like curious, like why do I have to do this? And then it came to a space where I started getting angry, mm-hmm. you know, like my brothers will like mock me and be like, yeah, serve me in my plate, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, haha, pick up my plate. And I was like, this is bullying, first of all, but mm-hmm. I was just not happy about it. Yeah. And I would express that to her, but it wasn't something I could change, essentially. Like, this is just what it is. This is what you do. Another thing is my brothers had other, like, opportunities that I didn't have when I was, like, mm-hmm. growing up. For example, they were allowed to go to the front yard, play with the neighbors. And me and my sisters were, like, in the house, and that's all we did. Mm-hmm. We were, you know, they had friends that would call them into the house or, you know, they would be on the phone and I couldn't get any call because she would curse them and then hang up. You know, she would do that. And then I'll go the next day like, you know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But that was just my grandma. My grandma comes from a, you know, a space that, yeah, she has that Catholic culture and morals and values where women dress, talk and do certain things. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to, you know, provide like that pureness and that conservativeness mm-hmm. in us. She also, like, you know, we'll talk about that her before she met her husband, she wanted to become a nun.
Mm-hmm.
That's all she wanted to do. That was like her dream. But she fell in love and got married. And that's what she wanted me to do. She'll tell me, yeah, I want you to be a nun. You know, and I'm looking at her like, what does that mean? But, you know, she comes from those like like that value, that strong, like the woman is pure. Yeah. And you, if you get involved, you know, in any form of like sensual intercourse is with that person that you married.
Yep.
And you're going to stay with for the rest of your life.
Yeah. And that's the deal. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to cook for them and you're going to take care of everything and clean. Yeah. And that's your job. Mm-hmm. So let's fast forward a little bit. So you graduated from high school and you're like, I need to contribute to my family. So I'm going to get a job. So you got a job at Little Caesars Pizza. We've talked about this, it's like, you were like, I'm not even thinking about college. I'm just thinking like, I need to help provide for the family. So I'm going to work. So that's what I did. And at Little Caesars, you like did a really good job. Like you were promoted. And like, how old were you when you became a manager?
I was 19, 20 years old.
And you were working with people that had been working there for like
10, decades. 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what happened in your life to make you think like, huh, maybe I should want more than this, or maybe I can do more than this?
I think it was those 3 years that I was working there. I realized, one, it wasn't a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I also knew that the other employees that were there were getting about the same, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm like, well, this is not sustainable. Like, how am I supposed to have a house? How am I supposed to, you know, just do more?
Yeah.
So, and then at that time, I also was with somewhat like a boyfriend who was going to school. He was mm-hmm. in his undergrad. Mm-hmm. He never like asked me like, hey, you want to go to school? You want to do this? But I was exposed to it.
Yeah.
And then the combination of, you know, like having the rebelling against mm-hmm. my grandma, although I don't think it's rebelling against my grandma at that point, but a lot of my things I did in life was as a result of trying to push out of those labels.
Yeah.
You know, those gender roles that racial roles that you're constantly confronting every single day. So I was like, okay, let me just try it out, go to school. Mm-hmm. But I had no one to like ask. Like I had my grandma, like, what do you think about this? Or mm-hmm. like my cousin, I was the first person in my family, you know, cousins, uncles, brothers and sisters who actually started going to school.
Yeah.
I had to figure out the system, like yeah. how to get financial aid, mm-hmm. how to register for classes, like how to even find a classroom. You know, I didn't know how to do all that. And that was pretty tough going mm-hmm. through that experience. And also like, you know, my family not understanding like the importance of school. Mm-hmm. I think now they do because they see a huge difference.
Yeah.
But then they would just tell me like, why are you school? Like school is, you know,
a waste of time. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a waste of time. Working. They would kind of like mock me about it. My grandma would tell me like, you're not making enough money. You know, you need to pay more rent or X, Y, Z. Like, why are you going to school? Just give up. Just find another job, get two jobs. Mm-hmm. And then I had to kind of battle that with my own struggles with being a, you know, first generation student, not knowing the system and not know even how to like get the guidance. Now I know that there's a lot of help in school. I just yeah. didn't know how to seek for it because I was just confused walking around campus, finding the class.
Yeah.
You know, so it was definitely tough.
And you got a job a work study job, because you started in community college. You were at Dominguez Community College, right? And so you got a work study job tutoring. And this, from my perspective, is really where things kind of started to click for you in terms of like what you wanted to do with your life. So why was that tutoring job? Like, A, why did you love it so much? And B, how did this really kind of set the stage for you in the career that you have now?
Yeah. So it was El Camino College.
Oh, my bad.
Yeah. El Camino College. I think initially I wasn't sure, you know, what I was going to be doing. I was told there's going to be like a tutoring job where I'm going to help kids read and reading and comprehension. And one of the first things I started noticing is the type of kids that would come in. You know, it was majority, it was Latinos and also African-Americans. And they were behind 6 months to like 3 years in English and comprehension. And that like really hurt me. You know, my emotion, like I kind of saw myself in them and me struggling as a young Latina that had gone through some form of trauma and never received like counseling services or things like that, or like the extra support. And I started, you know, like, let's make this fun for them. I started drinking like 2 Red Bulls. I started buying like little toys, like candy, stickers for them, just to make them excited about reading. You know, even if the book was just like, it's not the best one. Like I try to like, oh, you know, like this relates to this, and just try to give them a different perspective. And I loved it. I loved it. I remember my manager, you know, telling me that I could take his job. You know, he was just kidding, but he was really happy about the progress. And I think that's where it started kind of giving me a different perspective of what I can do. Because initially it was like school. Initially for me, it was a ticket out of the situation I was in, where I was struggling financially, where I didn't know where I might be. Just to survive. That was my ticket just to survive. I didn't even know if that ticket was going to actually, you know, at the end of that tunnel was going to give me something in return.
Yeah.
It's just like media. Media says go to school. My teachers would tell me to go to school and something positive would come out. For me, it was like, well, it's a ticket for me to just survive and see if I could come out of this. Mm-hmm. Right. And at that point, it started giving me a different perspective that I can make a change. I can make a difference. Mm-hmm. I've gone through my own struggles, and maybe I could give that back to the kids that I see struggling.
Yeah. That look like you.
That look like me. Mm-hmm. Or maybe so, Korea is something similar.
And originally you were like, oh, I'm going to, you know, focus on like anthropology when you were in school. But then you decided, no, you know what? I'm actually, because you had that tutoring job, going to focus on child development. And so you got all of the units that you had to get from the community college to be able to transfer to a 4-year university.
Yes.
And then you transferred into CSUN, which is Cal State Northridge. Mm-hmm. But that transition also was really, really challenging for you. Why was that so hard when you first started attending CSUN?
Well, one, I do think that CC colleges do provide a lot more support. Like I was receiving like EOPNS.
What is that? What's EOPNS?
It's essentially like extra help for students, okay, where they give you like counseling for what classes to take. Okay. They tell you what programs can be available. It's for, you know, for people who are lower income.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that was really meaningful support for you.
Oh, yes. Yes. I still have connections with them. Yeah. I still have the same counselor that I just saw like last year. Mm-hmm. And he's always talking about me and my 2 sisters, you know, mm-hmm. the three girls. You have a connection, and it's, you know, they try to get to know you and guide you. Mm-hmm.
And CSUN, just so people understand, is huge. This is a massive, I mean, I've spoken at this school before. It's huge. Like I got lost like 5 times. I mean, even just like the parking garage, I'm like, which parking garage am I going to? I'm literally parking on level like 38 FQ. It's huge. So that's a major, major transition, but also in the midst of this, you were really struggling financially too.
Yes. Yeah. At that time I was already working in where I'm still working at the same organization in applied behavior analysis. But none of my like employees knew where I was at financially. Like I was essentially homeless. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have, a roof over my head. Yeah. Sometimes I'll sleep over at a friend's house. Sometimes I would just sleep in my car because I felt bad. I was like, you know, sleeping in my friend's house. and it was definitely really like tough times for me. And I think the transition, also losing, like, we had like a little back house with me and my siblings, and losing all of that all at the same time, I think it caused a lot of emotional distress, where I would say that maybe I was feeling some form of depression, because I would sleep for about 20 hours and still felt like very restless. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to eat. I would force myself to eat at least one time a day. Mm-hmm. And I think I was just, what I think now looking back, I was definitely going through some form of depression. Yeah. My GPA from the CC college was a 3.7.
Yeah, 3.7.
And my first year in CSUN, it dropped for that semester, dropped to 1.7 GPA. And it broke me even more. I think out of everything, like losing our home, not being able to have like a place where you could sleep and just feel comfortable and feel relaxed. Mm-hmm. And what broke me the most was that. Yeah. Like, I cried so much. I couldn't believe how, like, drastically my grades had dropped. I've always loved school, ever mm-hmm. since I could remember. I think it was, like, an escape for me from, like, yeah. reality. It brought me joy. I could see my teachers, like, smiling, and it made me happy, you know, mm-hmm. make, like, poems, and I'll give it to them, you know. And I was that kind of student. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to sit in front of the class, and I just wanted to be ready and, like, make my teachers happy and learn. Like, mm-hmm. I found education to be very rewarding, very young age. And it when that happened in my young adulthood, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
It really hurt. So I slowly, you know, I asked, you know, to get more hours at work. I found like some form of stability, living, you know, just renting a room with like a whole different culture and like family.
But you look at the Sri Lankan family.
Yes.
You were just like, hey, like, let's do this like multicultural thing together. Yeah. This is going to be awesome.
Yeah. And they're so conservative too. Uh-huh. I love them. I love them so much. So conservative. Reminded me a lot of my grandma. Mm-hmm. And
you're like, different language, same rules. Different language, same rules.
Yeah. She was amazing. And I rented a room. I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time there because I was working. I was going to school. So it was just mm-hmm. a place where I'll be able to sleep, shower, and, you know, get the day started for the next day.
Yeah.
You know, thank God now that's not the case. I was able to finish college.
In 2017.
Mm-hmm. Finish my grad school and yeah, BCBA now. So not struggling financially, but mm-hmm. I definitely want to do more, right? So
let me talk to you. I want to talk about a very specific person who we both know very well. And also because I think like some people might have this perception that like, oh, reveal, like you're really focusing on, you know, female stories. Does that mean that you like hate men? No, it doesn't. it just means that we're acknowledging that there are, you know, some very specific circumstances that generally affect women. But the person that I want to talk about is a guy, and his name is Daniel Mendoza. And Daniel is a very close friend of mine. And someone that I've really cultivated a relationship with over the last couple of years. And he has been your, you know, supervisor. But I think more importantly, he has been a mentor to you for how many years?
It's heading to nine.
Nine
years.
And something that you and I talked about, and Daniel and I have talked about this before, and it's so important. Daniel is, you know, is Daniel first generation or was he born in El Salvador? Do you know?
He's first generation.
First generation, yeah, but his family is all from El Salvador. Mm-hmm. His mother also is in a similar position to your grandmother, that helping to raise some of Daniel's nieces and nephews. And Daniel's very involved also with his family. And, you know, his mother really struggled to make sure that she was providing for his entire family. And I don't think he would mind me sharing any of this. And the reason I want to talk about this is because I believe that part of the reason that you've been able to be so successful, especially working in behavior analysis and in your job, is because you had a mentor who really could see all of you, that understood not just where you were academically and where you wanted to go in your career, but really understood you from a cultural perspective and lived in a lot of ways, had a lot of the same stories. And can you just kind of talk about how you feel like that has really influenced you? Because I see you guys together, and I know Daniel so well. This guy has just like this like wealth of love, and he's tough. I mean, he's not like making it easy for you, but he is so focused on growing more talent in the brown and black community and focused on making sure that brown and black children really benefit from behavior analytics services. How has that shaped you professionally and personally by having this relationship with him?
Yeah, it's huge. I think it just starts off by when I was like growing up and not seeing anyone that looked like me that was in power. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's some form of self-doubt mm-hmm. that you go through. You know, media says that you're supposed to be a caretaker, or you're supposed to be, you know, cleaning houses, a babysitter, and then my grandmother is also saying, you know, women only cook and clean. And I, you know, I had the privilege of going to good schools as a result of being in the foster home system. And I didn't see teachers that looked like me, that mm-hmm. spoke my language. And there's like an identity issue. I was trying to find my identity, and I didn't know who I can be or where I can go. Mm-hmm. And when I got introduced to ABA and Daniel, one, it was like one of the first ones of Latinos that I saw in power. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, kicking ass, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm like, how are you dealing with that behavior? You look so calm, you know, like I would have been freaking out. Everyone else was freaking out, and he's just like, chill, you know? And I'm just like, how is that even possible? You know, I remember that day being slow motion for me. Like, I was so impressed. And I was like, what is this behavior analytics stuff? And also seeing, you know, like he would listen. What I will say is that he is a great mentor, like just listening. At that time, I mean, I was still going through a lot of pain, and I wouldn't really like talk about my experience or my emotions. I was more closed off about it. I, for example, like I had a boyfriend for like 6 years and never knew anything about me mm-hmm. in my family, that my mom was sick or anything. You know, I was yeah. really closed off. And he just knows how to dig, like, hey, how's your mm-hmm. mom? Or, hey, how's your dad? Or, oh, tell me about that. Like, what do you mean? Like, he showed interest in, like, getting to actually know you and mm-hmm. also, like, motivate you. And the biggest thing is, like, being able to provide that opportunity, like, new opportunities that I don't know someone else would have, you know, given me that opportunity. He'll put me in situations that will make me feel very uncomfortable and like, do it. Like, you could do it. Go. Like, you could do this. And even when I doubted myself, I still tried. He initially pushed me to like a position of like training other therapists. Mm-hmm. And from there, it was like actually training, like, teaching mythologies and mm-hmm. and like NET and like playing skills. And from there, like, I was part of the quality assurance, and now like he wants me to be host like his podcast for resilience mm-hmm. and I'm like, yeah, like, let's do it. And he's just like opening all these windows and all these doors that I don't know if someone else would have done that. Yeah. You know, and I think this is what you're supposed to do. You know, like, give back to your mm-hmm. community. Like, our kids, and I don't think all the kids are struggling in our community, but some of our kids are struggling. And us as adults, like, we need to be able to see that and provide, like, support, like, extra support.
Mm-hmm. I can't say enough great things about him, but also what I love in all of this is, you know, he's provided that to you. And so now what that has done for you is you have a very deep commitment to providing that for others. And that's, to me, that's how we make a change, is people take interest in us. They see us for who we are, our whole selves. People, you know, spend the time, they care, they invest, and that allows us to, you know, benefit from that. But then also then, you know, really, I think for people that have had those relationships with mentors, you know, I don't even know how to describe it sometimes. It's like you wouldn't even think twice about then providing that for other people. And so it's this like ripple effect. Mm-hmm. And that ripple effect grows over time. And that's where, again, where the change happens. You are, so out of the six kids in your family, three girls and three boys. So both you and now your sisters have all graduated from college.
Yes. There's two of them that graduated from their undergrad, and they both talk about going into their grad program now. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to like help them, like, you know, do some research. Let's shop around and see what you would like. Yeah. There's sometimes dual programs. Like, what are you interested in? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But let's talk about what your brothers have done. So this is, which is a very different experience than what you and your sisters have. What are your brothers doing right now?
My brothers are not doing so well. One of my brothers is essentially homeless. He goes to my grandma's house to eat, but he's like out in the streets, living, sleeping in the streets. Mm-hmm. He's had a pretty like tough young adulthood growing up. So he was a straight A student. My oldest brother was a straight A student all the way until he was in the 10th grade.
Yeah.
He didn't go to a really good school, which was Jordan High School in Watts. In the early 2000s, there was, you know, riots. Mm-hmm. And he got caught in the mix of that. He talks about that he turns around and saw someone, like a police officer, hitting his friend. So he goes and pushes that police officer, mm-hmm. and they start hitting him. He goes to jail for about like a year. Mm-hmm. And when he came out, he was a completely different person.
Yeah.
I can't like really describe it, but this was someone who I admire, because I remember trying really hard in school and I would get B's and C's. Mm-hmm. You know, and he would just like look, everything looked like too easy for him, and he would get straight A's.
Yeah.
Since he was like in kinder, and I was like, how is it possible? Like, I want to be just like him. And he came out and he joined gangs. He got with another girl that was also in a gang, and they had kids together. He was shot with a rifle that almost killed him. I remember like being in a movie theater and getting a call that your brother's in the hospital, you need to come quick. Mm-hmm. And he almost lost his legs. If you see his legs now, like the inside of his legs, there's like chunks missing.
Yeah.
I don't think he's ever been really able to recover. He has like a bad arm. He lost his daughter, his first daughter. So he has a total of three kids. He lost his first daughter at the age of 8. She had cancer. Mm-hmm. She fought it for about 2 years, but she passed away about 2 years ago. And I think a combination of all these things, like he's just, what I could say, like he's defeated.
It broke him. Yeah.
I try to talk to him. I try to give him like, hey, you could go back to school. Like, hey, you could do this and mm-hmm. you could work or you could do this. And he doesn't want to.
He's what about just, your other brothers?
My other brother is also not doing well. Mm-hmm. He also shows like signs of maybe some mental illness. Mm-hmm. He says he hears voices. Mm-hmm. He sometimes calls me like paranoid, like someone's watching him.
Yeah.
He does have a job. He's doing trucking. but he's constantly jumping from job to job. That's the second oldest. He was diagnosed with ADHD when he was about 7 years old, and he just jumped from like elementary to elementary school. Mm-hmm. He would constantly get into fights. By middle school, he was kicked out of like the LAUSD district. Yeah. He was sent to like continuation school. And this is where he's been at. I mean, my grandmother is a person of like strength, and she tried to like fight the schools, and like she will have like a lot of talks about ADHD and how to like provide more support. But, you know, it didn't necessarily help.
Mm-hmm.
I do think they also remember a lot more than I remember being in foster home.
Okay.
Remember more about my mother.
Because they were older.
Because they were older, yeah.
And they probably, they did not have, I mean, did they have the same kind of, or did they have any access to like counseling or support services to really help them work through those experiences or not?
No, they didn't. You know, they didn't. And I also do think that my grandmother somewhat enabled it, mm-hmm. you know, in the household, they weren't cooking or cleaning or, mm-hmm. you know, they could just be in video games all day long.
Okay.
And
so it's almost like they didn't have to build that fluency of like the responsibility mm-hmm. Of taking care of things, because that wasn't, you know, an expectation, versus for you and your sisters, you didn't have a choice. Of course you were doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I find, I mean, and we talked about this yesterday, and I was thinking about it before we started talking today. It's just, I find it so interesting that the kind of cultural roles that, you know, you and your sisters were kind of relegated to in one way felt so confining, but at the same time, it also helped build a foundation for you guys to succeed. And like, you know, so it's like so many things in life, it's not a black and white issue. And so by your grandma being, you know, so hard on you guys, keeping you in the house, you know, having you focused on cooking and cleaning, taking care of stuff, it kept you like on that straight and narrow path, and also building those skills of fluency in terms of like responsibility, accountability, that then you were able to kind of carry through in school and work. And what people need to understand about you is it's not like you're like, oh, I'm going to CSUN, this is awesome, I'm just going to focus on being a student. You're like, no, I was busting my ass, working as many hours as possible, sleeping almost never. And like, even when you lived with the Sri Lankan family, it was literally to like sleep, and that was about it. And even now, you know, you work so much because you're so invested in your career, and you have such a central role in the work for the organization that employs you, but also you are still also helping to take care of your family. How do you continue to take care of your family in the midst of your full-time job today?
Oh, you gotta make time. You have to make time, but it's a continuous like mentorship with me and my sisters. Mm-hmm. Like, so the organization actually gave them a job. So mm-hmm. all three of my siblings are working with SNN and mm-hmm. ABA. Mm-hmm. And I've been able to, you know, not get involved in like specifics of their cases, but just given mentorship. You have to work. You have to make sure you go to school. You have to make sure that you make school a priority.
Mm-hmm.
In any like situation where they may need like financial help, like I'm there.
Yeah.
We're constantly texting each other or having like, you know, Zoom chats just to like check in with each other. Mm-hmm. And if we don't hear from each other for a day or two, we're like calling like, hey, where are you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're definitely a great support system, not just I to them, but them to me as well. Like, mm-hmm. It goes both ways.
It's bi-directional. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then who does anyone still live with your grandma? Who lives with your abuela?
My youngest brother, although okay. He's not that young anymore. He's 24.
Mm-hmm.
He just barely got into ABA, and mm-hmm. he So he wasn't going to school at all. He didn't have like any intentions of going to school. He's one of them that will make like mockery of it as well. But he saw all his three sisters going to school and graduate and were doing really well. And he showed interest of going to school this year. He was like, I could give it a try. I'm like, yeah, what do you want to do? He's always been really good at math and science. He was like, okay, I just want to do engineer. Like, this is like easy for me. Let's just do that. Now he's been in the field in ABA for about 4 or 5 months. And he's like, I'm not too sure anymore. I could see myself doing this. Yeah. I'm like, oh my goodness, what's your decision? And I told him, but you definitely have to keep going to school. But it makes me excited, you know, like it just took one person to change the cycles of one family. And hopefully like I could touch my cousins' lives as well, or other kids that I work with. You know, like me being that child and not seeing someone else that looked like me in power. Now I'm actually going to these homes, right, in my community that I grew up in, and where they're brown and they're black and they live in similar circumstances like I did. We were a house of eight making $11,000 a year. You know, now I'm going into those same houses and they're seeing someone that looks like them. In a place of power, in a place of intelligence, in a place like, hey, you could do something, you know? So it makes me really happy to know that I may be touching someone's life and I don't know.
How do you think that your understanding of how all of us interact with our environments and the effect that our environments have on our own behavior has allowed you to be in a real place of compassion, especially for both your grandmother, but more for your mother? Because she has not, you know, she's been in a care facility for 20 plus years.
Yeah, 25 years.
25 years. And, you know, she has, you know, kind of ebbs and flows in terms of her ability to, you know, connect with you. And you have still, you know, remained so dedicated and loving to her, in the midst of all of this. Why do you think, or I mean, the answer to this question might be like, the behavior analysis hasn't helped me, Sarah, but if it has, I'd love for you to kind of share how is you having understanding how circumstances impact behavior allowed you to make room to still to love her, even though she couldn't parent you.
Yeah. You know what? Like, it always makes me cry talking about my mom. So that's what's happening right now. Just listening to you and thinking about my mom. Give me a second. I think, one, I always thought about, and I always, like, you know, kept thinking to myself, like, why did I get into this special needs, like, field? Like, why did it interest me so much? And I think it was my mother. You know, growing up and not having a mom, it's tough. But growing up and having a mother with mental illness where everyone is looking at you in, I want to say, like a negative way, like in a stigma way. And I'm already a brown girl. Now I already get that. But now there's like another label on top of you. And I love my mother so much, and I couldn't understand why she would behave in some manners. Like, she would talk very rational. She, you know, had episodes where she would attack my grandmother and start hitting her, and it was very frightening. And she still goes into those cycles. You know, I remember, and it breaks my heart when she goes into these cycles, because what ends up happening is that they drug them. Because they're not controllable. They're too aggressive. And I remember one time seeing my mother in a hospital bed, tied down with like her arms, her legs, and her eyes were like rolling, and she had like foam coming out of her like mouth. And it just like broke me. Like, I just couldn't believe this. I think that I could relate to some of our families that have like very severe problem behaviors and how society may look at them, and just seeing them, how they think others see them. I can't go out to the grocery store. I can't do this. Or, you know, like my whole family has already turned their backs on me. because my child is hitting, my child is aggressive, is making holes in the walls, and they have that same stigma. And I think I you know, I probably shouldn't be doing this, but I start crying too, you know, because I could feel their pain, because I feel the same way. So I think it's definitely grown like a different side of me where I'm very empathetic, and I will take that extra mile to try to see what I could do and help.
Yeah. You're like, I've been there. I'm still there.
Yeah. 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 I mean, some of the families I work with are barely making they're barely making it through the day. You know, a family just told me not too long ago that, you know, they don't have enough money, that sometimes they don't know if they're going to have food for the next day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can they get that toy that we need for programming when they can't buy food?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I asked the company, like, can we make something contingent? Can we, you know, if he makes, you know, behavior contract, if he makes mm-hmm. this, the company will give him this little toy, you know. And that's actually what I did today earlier. I went and dropped off his gift. I was like, you're doing really great work. You already finished X, Y, Z. Look, this is what you earned,
yeah.
You know. I remember being that little girl, like, I didn't get Christmas gifts, you know, I didn't have toys, I didn't, we couldn't afford it, yeah. Right? We couldn't afford these toys. We were a bunch too, 7 kids, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember my social worker buying me a little teddy bear, because I told him I wanted to be a doctor, I wanted to be a surgeon, specifically a surgeon, and he bought me a little white teddy bear and with a little kit.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was so in love with it, and I was so happy with my teddy bear. You know, I don't know what ended up happening to that teddy bear, but I still remember that special like moment in time. And I'm like, I think I'm doing that now to others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. So I think it's helped me in ABA just have a different perspective.
Yeah.
Sometimes we, you know, even right now, like we're going through the pandemic, there's a higher level of stress, not just with like us, but with the families. Like
yes.
It's, and I'm also stressed, you know, and mm-hmm. our families are like expressing all these things and they want more, or they see this, or this is a behavior concern. And it's like, well, you need to, instead of just saying like this family is just too needy, or this family is doing too much, is like, hey, this family needs support, this yeah. family needs more help, how can we provide that?
Yeah.
So it definitely changes my perspective on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think to wrap this up, I love to give benedictions. And so here's my, yeah, I'll, you know, I'm totally stealing this from Pat Fryman. He often uses religious metaphors to make secular points. So here is my, you know, secular benediction for you. I hope that you know, and I think you do, and I definitely see the impact that you are making. And also I love how much you can appreciate, acknowledge the impact that others have made on you. And you have this clear understanding of how that made you feel and how that affected what you did. And now you're doing this, you know, for others and for your community, because, you know, I think it was great that you were, you know, this like child that questioned things and why don't I see people that look like me in power? And why are all the people that look like me serving me or taking care of babies? And I'm just so excited to continue to watch you, you know, grow and develop. And I'm so grateful for people like Daniel Mendoza, who, you know, I mean, he's a pretty smart guy. we're able, you know, to, you know that you were just such a special person, you know, almost a decade ago, and has continued to, you know, help foster your growth. And again, the whole idea of that ripple effect, now you are part of that ripple effect. And the more people that, you know, pay things forward, the larger the effect is, the greater the ripple, and that, you know, it changes people's lives. So, you know, for you to understand that what you're doing is changing people's lives. It's changing the trajectory of your own family. It's changing the trajectory of the families that you work with. And my hope by having you on this podcast is to encourage other people to do the same, is that maybe there is another young Latina girl listening. That's like, I don't know, maybe I don't know really know what I want to do, but like, oh my gosh, I'm listening to Carolina Gonzalez and look at her. And now she's going to get a PhD.
Yeah. You know,
and that's not a player hating degree. You know, and so I just could not be more filled with joy that I know you, that I get to bear witness to this, and that I can continue to just like enjoy this and do whatever I can as like the big sister you never wanted. but now you have one. So sorry. I'm just so proud of you. I'm just so proud of you. And you know, I can't wait to see what the future holds.
Definitely PhD.
Well, obviously. This summer, you're like, let me tell you, Sarah. Hi, I'm nice to meet you. I just finished my master's. I'm taking my certification exam, so I'll be certified in 6 weeks. You were very clear about that. And you've done exactly what you said you would do.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, I'm breaking these ceilings, yo. Sky's the limit.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully, like, you know, and I'm very open about this. I try to be very transparent with what happened in my life, mm-hmm. even with coworkers, even with like people that I see that are kind of like confused that I was that age and I was also confused. I tell them mm-hmm. my story. I'm transparent because I hope that one, if they've gone through that trauma, which they probably have, right? Some form of trauma, it normalizes it for them.
Yes.
And it's like, hey, yeah, you could go through trauma, but you could still be successful mm-hmm. and you could still beat all these odds that psychology and society puts on you. You know, mm-hmm. like, no, like, it's beautiful. It's beautiful that, you know, society, like, in TV show like this perfect family, and not everything is going to fit in that black and white situation. You know, it's okay to be a little different, and mm-hmm. it's okay to have gone through something and still be a badass, like you say it, Sarah.
It's definitely always okay to be a badass.
Yeah. There's the badass.
Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Reveal. I hope that you were able to learn something, that you were able to grow a little bit as a person as a result of listening to this episode. And I hope that you follow this podcast. We're on like every podcast platform. So it's Google, it's Spotify, it's Anchor. And this is just the beginning of a lot more really awesome stories about incredible women that are doing amazing things. So have a great day. Follow us on all of the platforms. You can follow us also on Instagram at reveal.comm and also on Facebook, which means I'm going to have to get a Facebook account, but I'll figure that out eventually. Have a great day, guys.